I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Bill Arnott joins me again. He's just published a new book, A Season in the Okanagan. In the book, he takes the reader into the Okanagan region of British Columbia. It's a part of the province he knows, having grown up there. It's bucolic and a tourist attraction for those who appreciate the outdoors, wine, and bountiful fruits and vegetables. Bill doesn't just narrate his travels and the people he encounters, not to mention wildlife. He depicts what he sees through artistic renderings that illustrate how bright and vast the land is. Bill also shares conversations he's had with people who live in the region. He gets a great understanding of what draws people to the Okanagan, despite the ever-thickening smoke every fire season, or just the weather that's different there than here in Metro Vancouver, for example. If it's hot here, it's likely warmer there or colder there in the winter. Bill also looks at how history is depicted in public institutions like museums. He also takes the time to look at the land, history, and people through how the indigenous view the land. Bill Arnott is the best-selling author of A Perfect Day for a Walk, The History, Cultures, and Communities of Vancouver on Foot, which he was on this show with back in the fall. He's also written A Season on Vancouver Island, as well as the Gone Viking series. This new book is published by Rocky Mountain Books. We spoke a week and a half ago. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Bill Arnott. Mr. Arnott, good morning.
Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for having me back here on the commentary.
It's nice
Real privilege.
Nice to talk to you again. So we're just talking before we start about the artwork in the book, and I just found it visually arresting. I particularly like how you depict natural sunlight, because it really does shine through on the, well, I read it on a computer screen, but I mean it, on the page, if you will. It really does come through. So are they painted for memory, or do you do them on site, say?
Yes. Well, thank you. So as we're talking about A Season in the Okanagan, and you may have seen the precursor book, A Season on Vancouver Island. So I had some fun originally working with the publisher, and we loved the idea of mixed media. And I'd even explored, this is a long answer to your question, but we even explored working with other local regional artists. And at the end of the day, I had said to the team, well, look, I take these photos myself on my cell phone, and then I go home and digitally paint them. So I use a combination of devices. I've customized a couple of software apps to get that look and feel, which I feel adds that sort of sensory engagement. So that's a very long way of saying these are what you're seeing in the artwork in these season books, in this case, A Season in the Okanagan, is a photo I've taken on a smartphone. I then go home, work on a laptop, so I'm sort of skipping back and forth between the Apple products and Microsoft products, and I feel I've sort of rather innovatively captured these images. So I don't doctor my photos at all, apart from adding this wash, which has a little bit of some folks have told me, like an impressionist spin on it. Now, when you're talking about the light, I feel as though I got rather lucky with these most recent Okanagan travels in that the weather was spectacular. Mm-hmm. I chose a shoulder season, a bit of late summer, a bit of early fall. And although it can be awfully fun and effective to take those sort of moody, monochrome photos on a cloudy day, it just happened to be wherever I was, up and down the Okanagan Valley, spectacular weather. And then just with a bit of angling, I'm always looking for, can the light play in an interesting manner, or does it become part of the subject matter itself? So there's a terribly long answer, and I hope it did address your question.
Yeah, see, that's the other interesting thing is because I think you do say this in the book, if I recall, that the light shines differently over there, doesn't it, in the Okanagan than it's, say, in Vancouver.
Well,
and I think you've captured that in these photographs that have become, say, pieces of art, these paintings, if you will.
Yes, thank you. I like to feel that way, too. And you know, as from where we live here in the Lower Mainland, and folks may say this all over the globe, that, oh, our light here or our microclimates are unique and this and that. And yet, from an artistic perspective, there are, statistically, very specific places around the globe where the light really does seem to shine differently. Often, you're near or adjacent to a body of water. That alone can affect cloud, our perceived color of sky and flora, that kind of a thing. So, yeah, I do feel it's rather unique. And maybe that dry, clear air away from, you know, metropolis smog helps clarify things, like, quite literally as well.
The other thing that I found fascinating is getting to know you sort of in the course of reading this book. And I learned as I was reading the book that you spent the first 20 years in the Okanagan. Is that right?
Yes, I grew up in Vernon, B.C., at the north end of the Okanagan Valley, and I did a couple of years of college there and part of my working life there, and I still have family there, so it's still part of my, you know, travels and visits on a regular basis, although I've been in Vancouver now for 40 years. So it's very much what I loved about being able to create this particular book, A Season in the Okanagan, is I really honestly feel I've got the perspective of someone returning home, and yet with a traveler's mindset as well.
So it is still very familiar. I mean, there's a line in the book that I just love where you talk about your childhood home, and you could make it back there, say, blindfolded even, still. Do you miss living there? And I guess the better question is, what do you miss most, say, about living in, say, just take Vernon, for example?
Well, I'm sure I'm paraphrasing what many of us would think and feel and say. But the more you travel and explore, the more you find that every place around the globe has something special and beautiful and home-like to offer. Now, having said that, very, very selfishly speaking, obviously I had very specific memories tied to, in this case, Vernon, B.C., and the land becomes a part of my own history and narrative, and the lines blur between place and people, and I appreciate a lot of those things. So yeah, I still love elements of that, and of course, as a from a nostalgic perspective, I think a place can just you know, conjure up pleasant memories, and I think as a species we have a remarkable way of, you know, like panning for gold, retaining some of the nicest or fondest memories, and next thing you know they're stacked up, and you feel, oh, well, that's just a wonderful place with wonderful memories, and next thing you know that's simply the case.
And the thing is, I was reading the book, is that the memories, you know, are not just, say, visual. They're visceral for you in terms of, say, the smells and the sounds even. And I guess, you know, a few moments back in that part of the world, in the Okanagan, Vernon especially, I mean, you're taken back to your childhood very quickly, aren't you?
Well, yes, and, you know, apparently that's a great example. Scents, aromas are supposed to be one of our deepest and richest triggers, you know, with respect to personal history and memory and evocative sensations. So that's very much a part of it, and especially if you're in a part of the world where, you know, there's orchards, there's ranches, there's rich, engaging, evocative, not only sights, but in this case, the tactile stuff, touches and aromas, and that sort of a sense of connection. So yeah, it's very much, and quite honestly, you know, this southern part of the Okanagan, that's Canada's only desert, you know, when we talk about climatic zones. So it is unique in that regard as well. It's not uncommon to, you know, encounter a cacti when you're hiking, and what some of those pockets offer up all this rather rare, you know, and a wildlife and fauna. So that makes it all sort of contributes to that very unique perspective.
You talked about the climate. You know, one of the assumptions that a lot of us who live, say, down south in the lower mainland, Metro Vancouver, we have about, say, the weather there, is that when it's warm here or cold here, it's probably warmer or colder there, is it?
Yes, I would say, yep, the extremes are higher and lower, respectively. Something that certainly the tourist board likes promoting in the Okanagan is, which is accurate, four distinct seasons.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we experience that around Greater Vancouver to that same extent. And that's, you know, there's some very positive facets that go with that.
Yeah. The other thing is, you open the book, we realized just how, say, the smoke from wildfires, and not all of them are wild sometimes, you know, some of them are created by people, this is something that the people in the Okanagan have to contend with, say, with greater frequency than I assume when you were growing up there, right?
Yes, it has become more intense, more frequent. I think we could find this all over the globe. You know, we've had folks living with this as a big part of their lives, certainly across, well, Australia, the UK, but certainly the Okanagan, and obviously Alberta. But the Okanagan, the climate's a factor. Climate change is a factor. But you take an arid, you know, part of the globe, and next thing, you know, yeah, fire is very much a part of the experience there. And you're absolutely right. That is something that is increasing with frequency and intensity.
And it does
make for, I mean, elements of fear and then insurance issues that sort of perpetuate all the way through the system and the mindset and the economy. Yeah.
And as you start the journey at the beginning of the book, I mean, you talked about it being, say, late summer, early fall. You were asking people as you encountered them their stories or their experiences. And everybody, I guess, you know, had their own story, didn't they? I mean, as to what their experience was or, you know, how close it got to wherever they lived, right?
Yes. I feel I'd be doing a disservice to a lot of folks if I was to liken it to folks who have to live through warlike conditions. Having said that, there's elements of fear and uncertainty and vulnerability that go with, you know, that type of an environment. And even having folks, your neighbor loses their home and you do not, just by a roll of the dice or a blow of the wind or the next rain squall. Mm-hmm. So it's there's that element of uncertainty and it can be a very, you know, a strengthening bonding experience too. Once you know you get through the terror, and assuming there's, you know, hopefully lives aren't lost, but we've seen that a strengthening come to communities as a result of this in lots of Western Canadian examples in recent years.
And even with the smoke a problem, people still want to live there, don't they? And they choose to live there, right?
It's a good example. Yeah, that's part of the thing. Someone, you know, I would might speak to folks in rural communities and they would say, oh, don't know how you can live in Metro Vancouver, you know, traffic, air, are you concerned about a crime or this or that? And I suppose we all decide what we're willing to incorporate as part of our lifestyle and the benefits that we glean from where we work, and everything's going to have some pros and some cons to it, I suspect, be it natural or human-made, that kind of a thing.
By the way, when you go up to people and you're talking to them about their experiences early in the book, and you talk to people throughout the book, you know, that you encounter, do you find talking to strangers easy?
Oh, no. I mean, it's when I'm chatting with, especially if I'm chatting with other writers, most of this community tend to be shy, introspective, reclusive. The last thing in the world we want to do is go outside and talk to people. Having said that, it does make, you know, life better, and these connections and engagement, and it certainly, you know, results in a much more interesting or engaging narrative or read, in this case, in a book.
Yeah, you're right. It does make life richer if you do, you know, end up talking to somebody. Even though it's probably terrifying at the same time.
Right. People can be okay, generally speaking.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? You write throughout the book about the Indigenous and how they view the land, and I found that particularly instructive. And I'm assuming you have, too, as you've gone about your travels as you have. I mean, it's an important thing to keep in mind, say. I mean, even if you're talking about Ogopogo, for example, and you give us a little bit of sort of what the popular lore is in sort of Western narratives, if you will, and then you tell us how the Indigenous explain what's at the bottom of Okanagan Lake. I found that fascinating.
Well, yeah, I sure did, too. I mean, growing up with a very Eurocentric perspective and environment until, you know, just becoming more aware, more and better informed as to, you know, all of the layers of the narrative that, you know, are imparted on the land or that the land offers up. I just found that fascinating and engaging. I remember chatting with a publisher saying, gosh, as a white settler, you know, my lineage would be settler-based, although it's from across Europe. Is this irresponsible for me to share elements of someone else's narrative? And I was told in no uncertain terms, oh, no, it would be disrespectful if you do not, in fact, acknowledge these things that you were seeing, learning, and experiencing. That is an imperative part of this narrative mosaic and this quilt that we're a part of, and that recognition and acknowledgement and respect for being part of this land that we now inhabit, that is by no means our own, and by our own I mean a settler coming in and building on land that is unceded. So having said that, it became, although feeling at times sensitive, I liked and agree that it is an imperative part of the story to be shared, and just doing my best to share as many perspectives as possible while I'm doing these travels and talking and visiting and relaying these experiences.
What does that add, though, to your own conception or whatever you perceive as the history of the land itself? I mean, you know, you spent some time growing up there. When you do the homework, if you will, now, it does add a layer to your own connection to it, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I would just, if I had to put a sort of a, to articulate it or label it, I would say just a greater sense of awareness or empathy or open-mindedness, and just at the end of the day, the blurring of lines between any one place or person or people, just knowing that everything is very much shared and layered and collaborative. That to me is, you know, just a wonderful unending takeaway that, you know, we could impart that on any dealings with any individuals in any environment, be it work, travel, yeah, family.
You visit various museums in the book. And when you look at history as you do, especially some of the ugly parts, how are they doing in terms of depicting, say, history in these institutions like museums, for example?
Well, that's a great question, and something that I find very encouraging. The more museums I go and visit, the more I see a very proactive decolonization underway. Generally speaking, museums as a whole are, what I've seen certainly in my sort of Western-centric travels lately, has been very concerted efforts to share indigenous voice, rewrite exhibits, and, as they say, again, using that term, decolonize exhibits, and we can see that up through the Okanagan, not to mention the establishment and growth of purely indigenous-owned and operated museums and cultural centers and interactive displays. It's not only essential and long overdue, it's just so encouraging, and I find it wonderfully, yeah, enlightening and optimistic and positive. I just feel very, very optimistic with respect to where things are going in that manner.
So you took most of your travels via automobile. You rented a car, and you drove to throughout the region, as you do in the book. See, I don't drive, and so I would think that would be prohibitive for me to get around. One of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading the book is, because you do talk about rail, and passenger rail at one point was a thing in the Okanagan. Well, do you think it'll ever be again?
I don't, is the short answer. I'm still surprised that rail has been such a viable and essential commercial venture all around North America. And it seems the only place that passenger rail is economically viable is in urban centers. Or, if we're linking sort of more remote sites, it's either got to be heavily subsidized, and that's just not sustainable. We're seeing governments stopping. There's some, you know, so many of our Canadian suburban centers that were reliant on rail, it's gone. And so then that's a very, very tough, that's a huge political question that I lack the expertise, or we lack the time to start scratching that surface. But yeah, rail's not a viable passenger, or you know, there's a little bit of maybe tourist based rail travel still in existence, but even that's perpetually being threatened economically.
And it's only one part of the year usually.
Exactly.
And bus service, like you used to have Greyhound bus throughout the country, that's gone.
There's another example.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you as a non-driver, and you remember the last time we were visiting, we were talking about my book, A Perfect Day for a Walk Around Greater Vancouver, where that was very much all about exploring and being a traveler on foot. But this Okanagan, season in the Okanagan, I did treat it more as a road trip kind of a travel narrative and memoir. And that volume, that area is more conducive to getting around by a vehicle. But in that, as you also know, certainly am I making a point of stopping and getting on trails and hiking and walking as much as possible. But yes, getting up and down that Okanagan Valley from north to south and back again over the span of the better part of a season or two in this case did require a car.
Was it on this trip, this late summer, early fall sojourn of yours, that you encountered the ghost? The Countess's ghost? Or was that previous?
That was a previous trip up there where I was on a writer's residency, and that was back in Vernon, as a matter of fact, in a fabulous old mansion. But that was a previous one, so I'm referring back to that in this current narrative.
Yeah, it's a great story that you tell in the book, and I guess this was a writer's, a writer's retreat. And you're the writer in residence, and you get to stay in this mansion that was owned by this family. And I guess the last surviving member was a member of Italian royalty. Is that right?
That's right, Countess Sveva Catani. And so it's called Catani House. It's a marvelous community center now, an artistic center. Yes, as you say, I was the writer in residence there. It's a privilege and an honor, and I just happened to be there sort of taking the baton from another well-known Canadian poet and author, and she said, be aware of the ghost, and sure enough, I encountered it, and I know darn well, I'm sure some readers might roll their eyes at the story, but I am relaying my truth there. I'm not trying to embellish or create something out of nothing. That's just relaying my experience, and it was unnerving and yet by no means scary, just a little outside of sort of our typical parameters beyond that sixth sense, perhaps to a degree, and I've experienced that elsewhere. So, you know, my wife has said to me, you know, some of us might be a little more open to these kinds of sensory experiences, and maybe I'm on that spectrum, like many of us, to a degree.
It's a great story in the book, and I'm not going to tell the details because I think people listening to this will want to read the book for it. But on the issue of ghosts, I have never encountered a ghost in my 43 years, of life. But I guess I'm agnostic about it. I mean, just because I haven't doesn't mean they don't exist. And I guess I am open to it.
Okay.
I'd still be creeped out, and like you, I would sleep with the lights on.
Yeah, I'm not afraid to say I was very afraid. And it, as I say, in no way did I feel threatened, but it's just certainly well outside the realm of our, you know, day-to-day sensory experience.
Yeah.
If I see someone that, you know, if I'm in a dark alleyway and there's someone who may, you know, in the city, I mean, that's very tangible. Those are comprehensible things that one can or can't manage. But the intangible stuff, well, we don't really have a toolkit or an instruction manual for dealing with that. As far as I know, I sure don't.
I notice that Dairy Queen comes up in your travels a couple of times.
I am not sponsored by any fast food chain, but it just happened to be a fun one that kicked off the first my season memoir, season on Vancouver Island. and I felt that some readers would get a kick out of a sense of me picking up a thread that was left in the previous book to make this, although it's a standalone book, a loosely themed sequel or perhaps part of this little narrative series.
It's funny how chains like that play a part in when we travel. I mean, you could go anywhere around the world, and if you see a chain that you know from home, you'll want to go in just to compare even the prices or the how the food tastes. But the other thing, it's the comfort thing too, isn't it? Because, I mean, a milkshake at Dairy Queen, whether it's on Vancouver Island or here in Vancouver or in the Okanagan, probably tastes the same, wouldn't it?
I think so, but I think you've hit it on the nail on the head, that comfort. And then I suspect that was the first fast food restaurant we had in town in Vernon when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So, of course, that became a treat. It was special. And, again, I'm going to liken those memories with a fond time in life and good times and good recollections. So it all stems from maybe that sip of the milkshake in this case.
Yeah, there's another interesting thing you just said is that was probably the first chain that came into town. We do remember that. I mean, we remember the first McDonald's we went to or the first time. I still remember the first time Tim Hortons came to Vancouver, and that's not too long ago even.
Sure.
And yet, when you talk to other Canadians, you know, Tim Hortons is a thing that, you know, has been in their life for 40, 50 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's a wonderful thing to use as a comparison.
Well, right on. And thank you, Joe.
What, the book ends with a visit with your mother. What was that in Vernon?
Yes.
So at this meeting, it's a wonderful meeting where you get to catch up with your mom and her friends. At the end of the visit, she gives you a portion of your father's ashes. And you tell us what you did with them afterwards. I was curious to know what sort of container did she give them to you in?
Oh, it was like a little piece of cloth. Honestly, it was the size and shape of, a healthy-sized hand-rolled cigarette.
I see.
And so it was just easy for transport. I mean, there was no urn or box or any of that, kind of a vessel, as it were. But it was a lovely visit. And although we had basically said, we parted ways, said goodbye to my deceased father a number of years prior, then all of a sudden, it's fresh ashes. It opens up those things again to perhaps more closure, more healing, more, farewells, as it were.
It's a beautiful moment because you I don't know how you describe that because you don't really spread the ashes. It's a wonderful moment where everything comes together, if you will, because some of your early memories come back. Were you near that bench that's dedicated to him?
Big picture geographically, yes, but I was a few kilometers away from it.
Yeah.
As you know, by reading this book, A Season in the Okanagan, this one is deeply personal. I find it to be, I feel, very accessible and enjoyable by either an armchair traveler, or some folks are treating this book like a loosely based guidebook. But this one felt like a little bit of a vulnerable and sincere and honest share. And you seeing what you do, Joe, I appreciate that because it was vulnerable and important and heartfelt. And I think, again, very relatable, any and all of us that have, we all lose family members and friends, and then how that becomes part of our experience and fond memories. And in this case, the place itself being very much part of that touchstone.
You'll pardon my nosiness, if you will, but I asked Teresa Kishkin this. The container that the ashes came in, what did you do with it afterwards?
Oh, now you're testing my memory. Because it really was just like a convenient wrap for me to transport the ashes. To me, it was all about the contents rather than the
I brought up Teresa because in one of her books, she talks about taking the ashes of a loved one to, I think it was Tofino. And she transported the ashes in a Tupperware. And I said, well, what do you do with the Tupperware afterwards? I mean, I don't know if you'd use it for food or, I mean, and throwing it away doesn't seem like something that, that one would do either. And she couldn't remember either. But, I mean, it's just it's one of these things that, you know, you read about and you wonder, you know, what do you do with a thing, right?
Well, and isn't this interesting? She doesn't remember. I don't remember, which tells you that the whole experience is wrapped up in this case, those little ashes and bits of calcium and your memories, and it's, you know, the container is utterly irrelevant and forgettable.
Indeed. What plans for travel have you got for the summer?
Oh, well, I am now been privileged, so the BC and Yukon Book Prizes has me doing some book tours back through the Okanagan, which is a lovely privilege to revisit some of these experiences and meet folks and sign books, that sort of a thing. And, you know, our last visit was around A Perfect Day for a Walk here in Vancouver. So we're also finishing up a sequel to that called A Perfect Day for a Walk by the Water, again with Arsenal Pulp Press. So tidying up some travels, not only by car, but by foot. And that's the latest travel planning, and all of which feels like a huge privilege.
And the by water, is that around Vancouver?
Yeah, so following, treating my travels around Greater Vancouver in this forthcoming book, A Perfect Day for a Walk by the Water, it's literally how our shores have defined city, place, people throughout history, and it's an inverse perspective in my mind, the way you can imagine a photo negative, just turning that land-based perspective inside out or upside down, if you will, and it's amazing what new stories you unveil and reveal, and that experience, as you know, whether you're on a False Creek ferry or an aquabus or on a sea bus or crossing a bridge, it's a very different experience, looking out inwards versus outwards.
Yeah, that's the other thing that I can't get my head around. That I just found out about this, I don't know, about 10 years ago, about how a lot of that land where the new hospital will be, that's filled in, I guess for Clark to Main Street, how that was filled in over 100 years ago, and was water at one point, and I guess it still is. I mean, I work in a building on Industrial Avenue that's three or four stories high, but doesn't have a basement, and I've always wondered why, and I guess that because it's that it used to be water.
Yeah.
So it's just a fascinating thing about how, you know, how the water around us shapes, even though we live in Vancouver and we think, you know, our proximity to water is so close, you know, wherever we live.
Yes. And not only determining or defining our climate, but yeah, the economy is driven from that. And your Industrial Ave example is a perfect example. False Creek went much further east. Our downtown core ended much more abruptly. Lots of these things are reclaimed land. And so, in my mind, water is still very much a part of our story, even when it's not visible. It's beneath our feet and so on and so forth.
Well, we'll look forward to that book. But until then, I urge people to pick up A Season in the Okanagan. It's not a part of the country, the province that I've been in, but I so enjoyed the journey that you took us on in this book. Congratulations on this, Bill, and continued good luck with it.
Joy, I appreciate that very much, and thank you again for having me join you here on the commentary. Thank you.
The book is called A Season in the Okanagan. It's published by Rocky Mountain Books. It's author and illustrator Bill Arnott. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.